Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. One of the biggest players in the secret government, Henry Kissinger. What's he predicting for the Arab winter? And we look at the Russian elections, the downing of a state-of-the-art drone in Iran, as well as a new US law which will allow detention without trial. Also on to Parliament Square, and in the year campaigner Brian Hoare passed away, we hear from Barbara Tucker, who's following in his footsteps. And on the day Bristol City Council says it wants empty offices to be used for building homes, we ask a provider of food to Bristol's homeless and a former squatter, who is providing the funding for this new homeless initiative? But first, Billy Quain is with me, and Billy's here to talk about the Christmas shows that are on. Billy's from the Saturday Morning Arts Show. Hi, Billy.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Nice to see you.
It's great to see you too.
Now, you've been around looking at some of the shows in the city.
I have caught most of them so far. The elephants in the room that I haven't yet seen are the Hof down at the Hippodrome, because quite frankly, the allocation of tickets had gone elsewhere, and I'm not certain that I want to perpetuate the myth of the Hof.
I think we'll just we'll step round that one, shall we, and just ignore it for the time being.
Indeed, good thinking. And also, the Bristol Old Vic's main offering this year is happening at the Colston Hall. It opens on the 21st, I do believe. It's called Corn Boy. Lot of talk around town about this. It's
Corn Boy.
Corn Boy.
Corum.
It's based on a novel by a writer whose name escapes me now, but it's set up at Gloucester Cathedral, and a little of the story takes place in Bristol and also in London too, and it's all about a child chorister. It's based actually on the fact there was a chap called Sir John Coram once upon a time set up, not quite Borstals, but they were schools for street children, essentially. That's where the story takes its essence from, and then it takes you through, and there's some lots of lovely singing. It's based around Handel's Messiah. So
that starts the middle of next week.
Yes, it is, and it runs until the 30th. It's not cheap. I think the most expensive seats in the house are going for about £24 on that one, but you can get concessions, and if you're under 16 or under 18, I think it's certainly less than a tenner. Well worth going to see. There'll be 180 people on stage, so this is something quite new and interesting. It's a departure, certainly, for the Colston Hall.
So the Old Vic comes to the Colston Hall?
Yeah, pretty much, because as you know, the main house, the Theatre Royal, is closed for refurbishment, and I think the anticipated reopening date is, as these things always will, they'll slide back a little bit. I think at the moment it's set around April time. So interesting and fun stuff. If you would like a slightly more traditional theatrical experience, then might I suggest that you get up to the Redgrave Theatre this week. I think it runs again until Tuesday or possibly even Wednesday. It's Mother
Can you just
Goose.
Remind us where that is?
Well, now here's the rub. If you think Guthrie Road is the back of the zoo, Guthrie Road in Clifton, so it's Clifton College, and then you've got the zoo on the other side. The next road over from there, I can't remember what it's called, but it's down the next road, basically, at the bottom of that, and that's where the Redgrave Theatre is. It's in the middle of Clifton, quite difficult to find, but if you think Pembroke,
but even more difficult after your directions.
Well, after fashion, yeah. Sorry, I really haven't explained
that one
well at all.
Near the zoo, that'll do.
Yeah, it's near the zoo. Ask a policeman. There's plenty of them around there this time of year, usually. That's John Telfer and the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School are making an offering of Mother Goose, which, to be honest, the Old Vic Theatre School always put on a fantastic show, because they are the next generation of superstars, and also they have not the same kind of budgetary purse strings or shackles that an awful lot of independent private productions would have. So large cast, large talent, large entertainment. Go along and see it. Tobacco Factory are offering a plethora of wonders. They've teamed up with Travelling Light yet again, and this year they've brought us Cinderella. I went to see it last week. It is truly superb. Don't expect much by way of set, but it has got a wonderful soundscape provided by the Bauer Brothers throughout. I think the most expensive tickets for that are about £14, and the concessions will get you down to about £7 or £8. It's wonderful. do go and see it. Also, at the brewery, there's two different offerings. The Oxford Playhouse are sending down one of their...
The brewery, again, where?
North Street.
This is the Bedminster set.
It is. It's opposite Asda on North Street. So the Bedminster Church, I can't remember, it might be Peter and Paul's Church. It's just below that, next to... there's a bakery there, Bob's Bakery or Dan's Bakery. I can't remember. Anyway... go along to the brewery to see Peter Clifford doing Magic Crackers, which is I went along to see last night. It's definitely an audience participation sort of a show, but not in a weird and embarrass you kind of way, and he's certainly not going to hypnotise anybody, but he does require you to participate in order for some of the sleight of hand or some of the magic to actually work. There was 30 scouts in with us last night and they had a wonderful time. They were bamboozled in equal measure, I think. Bath time is for 2 to 5 year olds. That's an offering being made also at the brewery during the daytime. That's Oxford Playhouse have sent down some affiliate players, and it's, as I said, it's a young person's show. Sheila Hannon with Show of Strength Theatre Company are doing 3 days only next week at the Southville Centre with Recycled Stockings. It promises to be a wow of an event. 3 actors, 6 stories, and it occurs in Promenade, so you actually move through the Southville Centre. It's very accessibly priced at £5 a ticket. As I said, I haven't seen that yet because it's not open yet, but it does star Kate McNabb of the Ministry of Entertainment, so well worth going to see. You have 2 more nights to go and see the Morpeth Carol, which is the Bristol Old Vic's basement offering. It's by Sleep Dogs. It's a radio play. You'd be very interested in this, Tony. Tim XA Tech has written a radio play performed in front of a live audience, and it's a very, very dark Judderman, Tim Burton style, nasty Christmas tale of what happens in the far north of Northumbria. Also, Good Clown, Bad Clown is the Bristol Old Vic offering for 4 to 9 year olds. I went to see it a couple of weeks ago. I was the only man in the audience. I was there for professional purposes. You say the nicest things, Martin, you really do. It's a great show. It's clowning, but not in the kind of Ronald MacDonald stroke Pied Piper of Hamelin type of clowning. It's very much in the Grimaldi tradition, and it's a wonderful show.
Tell me, what's the Grimaldi tradition?
Well, it's a bit more physical, it's a bit more intelligent, and it's a little more intuitive, dare I say it, than this sort of really gaudy makeup that Disney has pumped us full of over the last 50 or 60 years. He's got a lot to answer for. Incidentally, I should say also, the Cinderella that is being offered at the Tobacco Factory is more akin to the Grimm Brothers Cinderella than certainly the Disney Cinderella that we know and love. But I would say, hand on heart, the show that I enjoyed most, purely a personal recommendation, was... Oh, I'm going to annoy a lot of people when I say this. It was Cinderella. It really was fabulous. And I think Lisa Kerr, a girl they found, she lives in London, but she is Northern Irish, plays a fantastic Cinderella.
Just remind us whereabouts that was.
Tobacco Factory on Raleigh Road.
They've done it again, haven't they? They've got the Christmas number one performance from Billy Quay's point of view.
I haven't seen Cornboy as yet because it hasn't opened yet, and I haven't seen the Hoff. So there we have it. But interesting, fun times. Thank you for having me in, Tony. Have a super Christmas. Incidentally, just picking up on the council spending money putting homeless people in office space, brilliant idea, but if it's going to cost them £100,000 to reseed College Green, frankly I wouldn't let them near the contract.
Okay, thanks very much, Billy. Can you just go, before you go, just give us an idea of prices for these places? I know you when you came in you said you weren't absolutely sure about plots. Just give us a ballpark.
I'm not certain
figures.
On any of these. I think Corenboy, most expensive seats might be somewhere around the £20 mark, but there are certainly under £10 seats for that one. That's the Colston Hall from the 21st until the 30th. It's a very short run. It's going to be the kind of thing never seen before at the Colston Hall, certainly not in my lifetime, and depending on the results we may not see the likes of it ever again. Tobacco Factory, the offerings in the Brewery Theatre are £10 for Peter Clifford, and I think Bath Time is £9 for an adult and very, very inexpensive for smallies. In fact, I think under fives might even go free. Don't quote me on that, but the Tobacco Factory box office will be able to tell you all about that. 9020344. Cinderella upstairs, I think, is £14 and £10 concessions.
And your aunt's show is when?
10 a.m. tomorrow morning through till midday live, where I will be talking to a locally based actor who is performing in Corenboy. I will also be talking to a selection of musicians and David Knott from the City of Bristol Choir, who are having their Christmas extravaganza concert at St. George's next Wednesday evening. Full show.
Okay, Billy Quain from Bristol Community FM's Arts Show, Saturday mornings 10 till 12. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, Martin Summers is here to discuss some of this week's international stories. Hi again, Martin. I think we'll start this week with this whole business of the downed drone in Iran. Turns out to be a state-of-the-art spy plane. These drones are sometimes equipped with air-to-surface missiles, which can take out houses, groups of people, this kind of thing. It's quite a serious incident. One of the things that I found fascinating about this is that the US denied it to begin with, and it was only actually once it was actually appeared on TV, pictures were actually shown of this new drone that nobody knew existed, that they finally admitted to it.
Yeah, well, the US drones are actually incredibly vulnerable. They don't like to say this because the people who manufacture them get a lot of money out of selling these things, so they don't actually want to point out to people. The Iraqi resistance worked out pretty quickly how to use very small, cheap electronic equipment to actually hack into these drones. Hezbollah in Lebanon, when Rafiq Hariri was assassinated, they were accused by the Americans and the Israelis of carrying out the assassination, but they were able to show that they were not involved because they'd hacked into an Israeli drone which was flying over the assassination point. And they didn't really want to do this, but they had to, in order to clear their name, they showed that they were actually hacking into the Israeli drones. And in fact, all these drones working in Pakistan and all the rest of it, they're all hacked. And of course, they're blowing all sorts of people up. They're very dangerous, nasty pieces of work, but actually, in modern warfare, they're like muskets, and other people have got machine guns.
Okay, just can we just go into this Rafiq Hariri thing slightly? Who was he, and why is that significant that there was an Israeli drone flying over?
Rafiq Hariri was the Prime Minister of Lebanon. He was basically a Sunni, and he was aligned, Western aligned, basically. I mean, the politics in Lebanon is that you've got a very complex political mosaic, but it's basically either pro-Western or anti-Western. He was pro-Western, pro-Saudi Arabian. And he was killed in a car bomb, which killed 20 somewhat other people. Or they said it was a car bomb, and they blamed Hezbollah. Hezbollah denied it, and in actual fact were able to show, because there was an Israeli drone overhead when this assassination took place. And Hezbollah claimed that he was actually killed by Israelis, by an Israeli drone. And they were able to show why they thought that, because they'd hacked into the Israeli drone, and they showed the footage that the drone was taking of the bombing. And I wouldn't claim to be any more of an expert on this than anybody. I just read stuff on the internet. But the fact that the Iranians are able to take one of these drones down does not surprise me.
Well,
lots of people have been saying that they're very vulnerable.
Well, let's have a listen now to Stephen Lenman, who was talking on the Iranian channel Press TV, TV channel, which has been threatened with closure a couple of times over the last few months by various people here in Britain, not to close the entire channel down, but to stop it being broadcast in Britain. And here's US talk show host Stephen Lenman talking about this earlier this week.
America controls the UN. It has its veto in the Security Council, so the idea of getting any justice through the UN is pretty, pretty slim. And of course, America is going all out to harm your country, sanctions, whatever effect they may have one way or another. So far, stopping short of belligerence, but your last presidential election, they meddled directly into that election, just the way they meddle in all elections in countries that are not U.S. client states. And the definition of a U.S. client state is the country surrenders its sovereignty to America's will and basically does what America wants it to do. Again, that really is outrageous. But America is waging multiple wars, especially throughout the Middle East. And, of course, illegally spying on Iran. It's done this for years. And they also have personnel on the ground. I think your government knows it and your military knows it. Once in a while, someone gets caught, and they never admit anything unless the evidence is so overwhelming they can't deny it. So you showed footage of this drone plane on the ground. Well, the goose was up. They had to admit it.
Stephen Lenman there from the website globalresearch.ca, speaking on the Iranian TV channel Press TV. So, Martin, when we talked last week a bit about this, there seems to be a sort of covert war going on by NATO and the West against the Iranians.
Indeed, and the Iranians, I mean, people say they're not a democratic regime. Well, they're not really. A bit like Colombia, it's not really democratic, but actually Ahmadinejad won the most votes at the last election. That's what independent observers said. So we're dealing with a proper state here, not a failed state.
And if we go back to the Cold War, we had incidents like Gary Powers being shot down in a spy plane from the United States over Russia.
It's worse.
Now we've got a situation with the drones that it's almost like they're expendable.
The drones are not the issue. MEK, Mujahideen Ilhaq, which is based in Iraq, the Jundullah, which is based in Baluchistan, the Kurdish Party of Peace and Life, I think it's called, all of the armed opposition to the Iranians is being supported by the Western powers. Now, what would we do? I just put it to the listeners. What would we do if the Iranians were paying terrorists to blow up things in Britain? We'd say we were at war with them, wouldn't we? Well, the Iranians have showed incredible restraint because that's what we're doing to them. And, of course, they are biding their time. Because when the war comes, they're pretty confident that they're going to win it. And you know what? They are. They are.
We've also seen this week the announcement of US troops leaving, or that the war in Iraq has been won and the US troops are leaving. Uh-huh. But if you have a look, you'll see there's actually quite a lot of mercenaries who are staying there, plus a lot of US soldiers staying there to do a continuing rolling training program. So one of the headlines, for example, Agence France-Presse was US in Iraq, soldiers out, Blackwater in.
Yes, and of course the other thing about the Iraqi government, which is kind of, again, semi-democratic, a bit like the Iranian government, is that they support President Assad in Syria, and they support the rebels in Bahrain. And so America has gone to war in Iraq to put in place a pro-Iranian government. That's what the people of Iraq wanted.
But that's what is being said
about
that.
Of course,
that
the Iranians and the Americans go, but you can't do that. And they're saying, yes, we can.
Well,
that's why you've got to go home.
Much of the Western press is saying, and Western diplomats, is that Iran has been infiltrating into Iraq. And this is actually the Iranians that are now trying to control the Iraqi government, this new government.
Nouri al-Maliki, who's the head of the Iraqi government, is a very close ally of the Iranians. And there's nothing they can do about it because the Americans got him elected. And, of course, in actual fact, inside Iran, the Western powers are engaged in terrorism, as they are in many other parts of the world. And of course the British people blithely wander along going, oh, is that what's going on? Are we blowing things up in Iran, are we? And the only way they're ever going to find out that we're blowing things up in Iran is if the Iranians come here and blow a few things up here, isn't it? There's a tremendous complacency in this country. We watch the TV about our armies marching hither and yon, and we just think it's just TV. Now, these are real people in real countries, and if you want to go to war, you better get ready to go to war. And it's not like going shopping or going to a football match.
Well, on Thursday, that's yesterday's Newsnight, we had Henry Kissinger popped up on, who was the former Secretary of State in the United States under Richard Nixon. He has been a long-time advisor to American governments, and he also runs his own company, Kissinger Associates. Now, many people see Kissinger Associates as a sort of independent arm, sort of almost like an independent army that actually does interfere on, particularly on cross-border problems. Now, anyway, Henry Kissinger, what do you make of him, Martin? He stopped being in politics something like 25 years ago.
He's still influential behind the scenes.
After being involved with Nixon in actually orchestrating the coup in Chile. So what is this guy still doing in politics?
Well, he's always been in politics. He's never gone away. I mean, he's a big cheese, always has been. He didn't just carry out the coup in Chile, he bombed Cambodia, he did all sorts of nasty stuff. In a fair world, he would be in prison. He's not in prison, he's in power.
It was interesting.
That is the problem.
I felt it was interesting quite watching him last night on Newsnight, because I noticed that Jeremy Paxman wasn't presenting it, because something like 10 years ago I was listening to Start the Week, which was Jeremy Paxman, and he had Henry Kissinger on there with his new book. And one of his first questions to Kissinger was, do you feel a fraud accepting the Nobel Peace Prize after orchestrating military coups?
Well, yes, and the fact is that Kissinger is not able to go to certain countries, like Bush wasn't able to go to Switzerland the other week, because in actual fact they've all got Interpol files. When we say these people are criminals, that's not political rhetoric, they've all got Interpol files.
So why are the BBC asking him for his pearls of wisdom on what's happening? I suppose it's because he's still a power player.
Yes, and you've got to talk to the people in power, but what we should be saying to them is, you're in power at the moment, but we intend to take you out of power and we intend to put you in prison. that's what we're going to do to you.
Anyway, here's Henry Kissinger talking about Western democracy and how it might or might not translate in the Arab winter and is after the Arab Spring in the Arab world.
Our conviction would, of course, be that we favour a pluralistic democracy in which minorities' rights are respected and freedom of religion is maintained. Our capacity to bring this about is shrinking by direct action. So it depends on the relationship that will evolve between the West and the emerging countries. The danger that I see is that the democratic processes and slogans will be used to destroy the rotten regimes, and that is a great achievement. But that then a sort of one-party state develops on, say, in an Islamist basis. And I notice that there it is often now the Islamists are congratulated when they ask other parties to join a coalition government. But an all-encompassing coalition government means that there is no opposition, no formal opposition. That is a challenge.
That's a bit worrying, isn't it? What Kissinger's saying there is that there may be, in some of these new states like Tunisia, Egypt, etc., no real opposition in these governments. It's not really a democratic system then, is it?
Well, it's just huff and puff. I mean, I remember what he said about Chile. We can't allow Chile to go communist just because of the irresponsibility of its own people. And it's the same old, isn't it? Henry Kissinger is going to tell the Arab world what to do, who they can elect, who's acceptable, who's not acceptable. Do you know what? He should just go back to his own country and mind his own flipping business.
And then he also was asked about what he thought the prospects were for Syria.
I think it will end up with the collapse of the Assad regime because the pressures will become too great, and a situation either like Libya of an uneasy truce but with a good possibility of a civil conflict.
What he's saying there essentially is, Martin, another Libya.
Well, he says another Libya, except that Iraq is going to fight on the side of the Assad regime, so is Iran, and we're talking about World War III. And, of course, that's what they're engineering inside Syria
as
we speak.
But these are civil wars. It doesn't.
They are civil wars. Indeed, all this stuff about peaceful demonstrators, there were peaceful demonstrators at the beginning, but it's now a civil war. It's a Sunni versus Alawite civil war. It's like Iraq Redux, and the West is fanning the flames. U.S. troops have been seen in Jordan on the border. Where all the fighting's going on in Syria is just on the border with Turkey and on the border with Jordan. Damascus is relatively quiet.
Well, there's even some people saying that
the
troops,
it's foreign infiltration that's creating
the U.S. troops that are leaving Iraq are not actually necessarily all of them going home. Some of them may be getting ready for
They haven't all left Iraq either, of course. This is just this is again just play acting. Now, I'm not supporting the Assad regime. They've got plenty to answer for, but the West is actually behaving totally irresponsibly by encouraging civil war in Syria. And of course the Russian Navy have put one of their carrier battle groups in Tarsus, so when the Americans arrived with their aircraft carriers to put a no-fly zone in, they found the Russians are there first. And if they try and take down the Syrian Air Force and the Russian Air Force with the Iranians backing the Russians and the Syrians, well, happy Christmas everybody, war is over.
Well, what about the Iranian government though, because they're now talking about having an exercise which is
to
about
close
closing
the
Straits of Hormuz. Now, what is the significance of doing something like that?
Well, it'll whack the oil price through the roof, and really,
just an exercise.
Yeah. They are getting fed up of being intimidated. Yeah, but what the West has been doing for years now is just every time they try and negotiate, they just turn up the pressure. They put the Stuxnet worm in there, which crashed all of their nuclear stuff, which actually had an influence on Fukushima, of course, because Stuxnet wasn't confined to Iran. But Israelis and the Americans openly say they did that. They kill their nuclear scientists. They're backing all the terrorist opposition. MEK are complete nutters, but they're being backed and trained by our special forces. And of course, the Iranians are showing incredible restraint, because if they do anything, they know that the Americans will go, oh, there's a very interesting pamphlet called What Path to Persia. It's a Brookings Institution pamphlet. Look it up on the internet. And it's where people like Kissinger talk to other people like Kissinger about how they can trick Iran into a war, or trick the people of America and the West into war with Iran. And they're very open about it. They want a war with Iran. And of course, if I was the Iranian general staff, I wouldn't wait for them to attack me. If you know you're going to be attacked, then you kick them in the first, don't you?
Okay. Finally, on that Newsnight thing, there was one very interesting contribution from Gigil Ibrahim, who was one of the original activists and campaigners in Egypt, about what's happening there now. and she was rather rudely interrupted by Kirsty Walk, as you'll hear.
Persecution is happening from counter-revolution that is being led by the military Supreme Council for the Armed Forces itself, which is again backed by $1.3 billion a year from the U.S. and the Western government. I mean, you are talking about the role of the West and in relationship with these revolutions, and it has no positive impact on it whatsoever. I mean, if anything, it's backing up any revolution progress, because it's supporting the exact entity, which is the Supreme Council, that are running people over in protest, especially
right. Well,
Christians,
let me put this to
like what happened with the Maspero massacre.
Let me just put this to Tarakel.
Yes, that was from last night's Newsnight. What she's saying is that the Supreme Council, which is this army body in Egypt, is actually being massively financially backed by the West. So that's not helping democracy in Egypt.
No, and it's not helping democracy in Yemen, or, dare we mention it, democracy in Saudi Arabia that keeps filtering in its overtime. People want to be meddle in these affairs, but when it blows up in their faces, they're going to say, why did that happen? Frankly, people are fed up to the back teeth of Britain and the United States and Israel walking around the world and telling everybody what to do. They've killed millions of people, and people are fed up with it. And when World War III breaks out, it's going to be the axis of evil, Britain, US, Israel against the rest, and the axis of evil is going to lose.
Well, that's what you're saying. Anyway, one person who is a sort of almost an alternative opposition to the Labour Party in Parliament is a woman called Barbara Tucker. She has picked up the mantle, really, from Brian Hoare, who was voted Channel 4's Political Personality of the Year, I think it was in 2007, who had a peace camp, peace and justice camp. And I spoke to Barbara Tucker earlier this week about exactly what her protest there was all about.
Today's General Sir David Richards has come out and said the greatest strategic risk to the UK is the economic crisis. And I just spoke to a journalist from Time Out, actually, and I said, no, the greatest risk to the people of this country and other countries is that whether they're the government, the army, or the bankers, they're all failing to adhere to the rule of law with checks and balances and safeguards. If we had law, you know, that actually worked, and we had a system that protected the people, everything would be okay, really.
Just give us some examples where you think it's not working, then.
For example, when they've gone to their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, clearly wars of aggression and collective punishment on innocent civilian populations, where 90% of the casualties nowadays are civilians, are war crimes. You know, but where do we see the ability to bring these people before courts? Because the system has completely failed to protect human life. And if we could stop these people from their land grabs, their resource grabs, you know, everybody would be able to live in peace. And I also have this theory too, you know, we didn't make the earth, so how could we own it? And if there's a human right next to the right to life, everybody had a little piece of land, you know, you'd have security for life. You wouldn't really mind if someone had an oil well next to you, would you? Because they're not going to throw you off your piece of land. And it's just unadulterated greed, the world we live in now. You've got hedge funds really trading on human life.
But this idea of, as you were saying, security of tenure isn't even really on the agenda. If anything, the government at the moment is trying to make people's social housing less secure. It's trying to remove people from housing where maybe they've got a spare bedroom.
And that's why I think that maybe, you know, maybe we need a radical change to the way this government operates. Perhaps, you know, somebody could come up with a manifesto that they put before the people as a referendum, and that manifesto was a constitution which gave the power back to the people in terms of said, people, you make laws. These people in government, the bankers, the army, they simply can't be trusted. We need to give the power back to the people. And it's how, I think if you look at what's gone on this year, it's a year of protest, really. If you look on what's happening around the world, it's how many people are going to be willing to stand up and stand their ground in front of government saying, actually, the power will be with the people?
Well, yes, but that's kind of happened with the Occupy movement. Certainly, we've got our Occupy here in Bristol. We've also got St. Paul's. But there hasn't, so far anyway, been a clear message from them about reform or change, other than we want the rich to pay more tax and to pay the tax they're supposed to pay, and corporations too.
Well, that's where we're fundamentally different. And this is a 10-year campaign that started 10 years ago. We're fundamentally different, saying, you look at solutions about justice for everyone. You know, it's beyond what is the root cause of the economic crisis, because there has been a failure to have a system of law. And I think that's where we're different. That's why we're outside government, because I had a Lord come over a few weeks ago and he said, what on earth do you want? And I said, really? You know, it's about government brokering a deal between the people and business. You know, it's simply gone too far the other way. So we're clear, we want justice for everyone, and we see it as coming through having a proper system of law, because then you can put controls and so forth on bankers and what have you, but you can also hold, you know, the army to account for war crimes and so on and so forth. I think law covers everything.
Barbara, your situation on Parliament Square there, how secure are you? And because I know we've seen with the Occupy movements in the United States, actually quite a lot of severe policing turning up in the middle of the night, putting everybody's belongings into rubbish crushers. You know, how secure are you?
Well, really, the argument that's going on here is about the duration of a campaign, really. You know, we're saying we're here for as long as it takes to stop the campaign the government are having to sort of wage war against the people everywhere, really. What they're trying to do is limit the duration of campaigns everywhere. And so really, I mean, we've had this here. I've been arrested 43 times, been to prison twice. While I was in prison and the campaign was manned, the police just stole it, lock, stock and barrel, destroyed it. They made a whole lot of new laws against us, some of which have gone out to consultation. And the bottom line, you know, I said when they had the royal wedding and the world's press came here, I said, you know, and they said, what are you going to do when they move you on? I said, where are they going to bury the bodies? You know, those young people in Egypt, okay, you know, the West was trying to control all these uprisings everywhere. Of course they are. But those young people in Egypt, you know, they laid down their lives and they, you know, it was awful. They said, you can kill some of us, but not all of us. And really, in the West, we could have stood up to our governments far more to protect even those people, because we've imposed those dictators. So I think it's in the next year we need to see how many people are willing to stand their ground peacefully, because it's a numbers game. If 1 million people took 1 week out of their 4 weeks annual leave to work for the greater good, everyone, who could refuse to do that? 1 million people here for a week peacefully, you outnumber the government. They haven't, you know, the army's busy elsewhere. They haven't got enough police. You can do it peacefully. It can be done peacefully. We're not going to use weapons against the government. If they want to bring out weapons against us, how many of us could they really kill? You know, and we'd be working for the greater good. And who could refuse to spend 1 week? Brian never wanted to spend 10 years here. I never wanted to spend nearly 6 years here. You know, it's about people learning how you bring about change. And this is one way you can do it.
Well, Barbara, a lot of people might say, well, we had in 2003 between 2 and 3 million people out on the streets. And then they were ultimately just ignored. We've just had this week the Americans supposedly withdrawing finally for a second time. They've said they've won the war in Iraq and it's time to go home, this kind of thing. Actually, they are leaving thousands of mercenaries and trainers in there. So that hasn't really achieved anything. And in fact, it's been a PR victory despite the 2 to 3 million people that turned out to stop it.
Because people have to think tactically, because that's what this government do. You don't march away from government and register your disapproval on one day. It's going to take a little bit longer, and you have to be where you can put pressure on. We marched, you know, as part of that big march, we marched away from government for one day to register our disapproval or to make a point. This campaign in Parliament Square, where we're surrounded by fences, we're getting gassed on the pavement. You know, this is not about registering our disapproval. This is about saying, think tactically, and you can bring about change. Those young people in Egypt, you know, they've just started to do something against all the odds. It's a numbers game. They need, like, the Muslim Brotherhood standing there alongside them. You know, it's people working together and thinking, you don't just change the world in one day. You know, Brian and I accepted that we were here for a long time because people need to understand, because the press won't tell them, that you have to be consistent, you have to be determined, and don't listen to what the press say, that you can't do it. It's a numbers game. Of course you can. But you have to be consistent and determined.
You're obviously running quite an important campaign there. In a way, it's almost sort of another opposition, you know, on the opposite side of the road to the House of Commons. How have you managed to keep going, and have there been campaigns to try and undermine what you're doing?
Well, yeah, we have a campaign next to us. And really what happens is when you set up something real, as Brian did, I mean, the man had incredible insight, but he travelled the world, he'd seen all sorts of problems that people have everywhere, and really it's inevitable when you set up something real that people will set up things around you to dilute your message, for example, we talk about war crimes and torture. We have a campaign next to us that says honour the troops. So anybody looking at that would be confused. At one point we're saying honour the troops, which is not our campaign. And another one where we're saying, well, US, UK, NATO war crimes, torture, and we're showing graphic pictures of real civilians dying. So that's one of the methods they use. And we speak to people in other campaigns in other countries, and it's fairly standard tactics that they've done throughout the years, trying to discredit you, use drugs, alcohol, so on and so forth. Usually, they use them as sort of a front to speak to the media as well. I sort of work on the theory, as long as you're telling the truth and you know where you're going, you can't go far wrong.
Give us a bit of an idea of your background. I mean, you seem to be very much aware of politics and also of almost like the tactics of campaigning.
Oh, maybe I'm a daddy's girl, I don't know. My father, he served in the Second World War, and he was the one that opened my eyes, you know, to the fact, he said, you know, the first casualty, that old saying, you know, the first casualty of war is the truth. But in my mother's side of the family, we go all the way back to Vice Admiral Fremantle, who fought with Nelson at the Battle of Trafalgar. And both my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather were admirals in the British Navy, Sir Sidney Fremantle. And what I'm saying is, you know, I lay down my own life here in Parliament Square rather than watching my sons go off and fight for the lies of this government, because I grew up in a world full of lies. I didn't even know what a communist was till I grew up, and then I went, they're really not that frightening. And it was when I went to Gaza when I was young, and I've been brought up with so many lies, and you see the cognitive dissonance. Here's what I've been told. Here are these people really suffering. And I think we're standing outside a post office in Ashkelon years and years ago. I was standing in a queue, and a man came up to me and said, you don't have to stand in this queue. And I said, why not? And he said, because you're not an Arab. And I stayed in the queue, and that was sort of my first conscious decision to stand for justice. I spoke to young men my same age in Gaza who said to me, tell the world we have no hope, and things have got worse. So people have to just stop and think. We rush through things too quickly. We've been brainwashed by the media. We've all been there. And once you step outside that and look at the real facts, I think you make up your own decision. But certainly my background played an influence. And I sort of said to judges, I said, you have spat all over what you claim my father fought for as you prosecute me for speaking out against what this government are doing. Where is the freedom of speech? It doesn't exist. There's so many lies they tell, and it's trying to break down those lies. I just have a belief that you live, you breathe, you die, you don't cause any harm to another human being. It's no ideology. Well, I said it's God's law, really. And when I stood up in the High Court recently, I said to the High Court judge then, you know, Acts 5:22, I will obey God before man.
Barbara, obviously we've lost Brian. What do you think is his legacy, and how have you picked it up?
Well, we continue with our campaign that he started 10 years ago against all the odds, but it's almost like when you put pressure on somewhere. This year, you see people coming out around the world doing what Brian started all those years ago, and we will continue to stand here. And, you know, we have people come from around the world here. You know, we're saying it's not easy, but you can do what we're doing. Of course, in some countries they can't. They just straight out murder them. But while we can still hear, it's really, really important.
Can you just give us in a nutshell what Brian stood for?
Justice for everyone. So, you know, his slogan was peace, love and justice for all. It's that simple. Yeah.
That was Barbara Tucker speaking to me live, well, not live, but as you could hear with the police cars and things in the background and Big Ben bonging away from Parliament Square. Martin, what do you think is the significance of this campaign? Because she's really, it's been going for 10 years, a little thing on Parliament Square. Brian Hoare's not with us anymore, but Barbara certainly is.
Well, we've all got to take something of that spirit, haven't we? You can't just turn up one day and expect you're going to change the society. It's a lifetime's commitment, and we've all got to pull our finger out and get stuck in.
What she's suggesting there is that maybe people can take a week out of their 4 weeks holiday and do something during that week.
Well, we've got a million people under the age of 24 unemployed in this country. I suggest they should be in the streets. But that's where they should be.
But don't you think that the... I mean, the students certainly have been, a lot of them. Don't you think... I mean, what's effectively happening here is that people don't have the free time to spend on campaigning.
Everybody can do something. I think Bobby Sands said years ago, there's no task too big or too small. Everybody can do something, and everybody must do their bit, whatever their bit, that bit is. We know that some people have got time and other people have got money. Do something.
Now, we've also been talking about the stuff that's been going on in Syria and the Middle East, but then there's also been a bit of a shock announcement this week that the United States is in the process right now of passing a law, and Barack Obama has said that he will not veto it, although beforehand he was saying he would do, and this is to do with internment, basically, in the United States, so that the US military will actually be able to lock up American citizens without a trial, and what will happen is that they will have a right to be seen by a military committee once a year, but they'll be in jail without trial.
Ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And if you look at most of the terrorist trials in the US, they are all virtually 100% basically provocations, where the FBI have set up a terrorist plot, tricked some stupid people into it, and then arrested them all and said, oh look, we've captured all these terrorists. But all of these plots were actually orchestrated by the FBI, and that's under the existing setup. So once you've got an illegal detention structure where you can just put people away, like Haroon Aswat has been illegally detained in this country. He was named as the mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, but he's never been to court because he's being held under habeas corpus, without habeas corpus.
Yeah, but Martin,
and of course named by John Loftus as an MI6 double
agent.
But
Martin, Senator Lindsey Graham said the extraordinary measures were necessary because terrorism suspects were wholly different to ordinary criminals. He said, we're facing an enemy, not a common criminal organization who will do anything and everything possible to destroy our way of life. When you join Al-Qaeda, you haven't joined the mafia, you haven't joined a gang, you've joined a group of people who are hell-bent on America's destruction and who are a military threat.
Yes, Al-Qaeda is a military threat. It's run by the CIA, and we should do some waterboarding up at Langley, Virginia. And I want to see some four-star generals given some waterboarding, and then we'll find out who really is running the terrorism, eh?
And finally, over to the UK, British police are going to start to use tactics to blind protesters. This is according to the Press TV again. British police have decided to make use of a laser gun, which fires a blinding wall of light, making their track record in employing brutal techniques even worse. Severely criticised for their use of these 40,000 volt taser guns, tear gas, pepper spray, batons and rubber bullets in order to tackle public disorder, the Met have now decided to resort to laser weapons. The proposed laser gun is a shoulder mounted device known as an SMU-100, which would temporarily blind anyone who's caught in the beam. The device costs around £25,000 and fires a 3-square-metre wall of light which can be projected up to half a kilometre away.
Yes, well, many people in the United States have got automatic weapons. That's my answer to that.
How do you mean?
Well, if you're going to start using laser things, I mean, there's a real possibility that we're going to have civil war on the streets of America. And civil war will mean that there's plenty of guns, finally, never mind laser guns. Those cops that are using those laser things better watch behind them, because somebody with an AK-47 is going to blow their head off. Nasty business, isn't it, warfare? Not for the faint hearted.
93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, thank you, Martin. Inflammatory as ever. Now, we're going on to take a look at homelessness. On the week, I heard today on Radio Bristol that the City Council is proposing that empty office buildings, and there are plenty of those in the city, not mostly at Temple Quay, but some of those are empty too. And also the first street I've ever seen in Bristol where one entire side of the road is boarded up. So I'm joined now by ex-Bristol squatter Anne Bonney, and also by Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries. Hi, you two.
Hello there.
I think with you first, Paul, can you just tell us what you do?
We run Crisis Centre Ministries, which we have a number of services. Possibly the best known is the Wild Goose, where we serve around 300 to 400 meals for homeless people each day.
And why do you do it?
We do it because those people need the food, and they need somewhere safe to come, and they need people who will be there and understand them, so that we've got a hope of helping them move forward in some way.
So in your experience, what leads people into these kinds of circumstances?
A whole variety of different reasons. I mean, there's two basic routes. I mean, one is you have a troubled childhood, difficult upbringing, maybe excluded from school, get into trouble with the law, petty crime, drug dealing, problems, all that sort of thing. The other major route is people who are successful in some way and they start drinking or taking drugs because they can. And
well, because they've got a good income.
Yes, absolutely. And they keep this up for a long time, and then sooner or later it comes crashing down around their ears and they end up homeless, you know, without without a job, without a family, and nowhere to go.
Now, in the Evening Post on Monday, we had an article suggesting that there may be some closures to hostel places in the city for homeless people. So can you tell us roughly how many places there are at the moment, and what's going to be going on with that?
Okay, well, at the moment, they have on their books 436 places, and they're planning to lose about 85 of those. So around 20% of their hostel places are planning to be cut.
Now, as one of the proposals sort of to counter that in a way, we've heard Anthony Negus on Radio Bristol today, who's the City Council chap in charge of housing, saying that they're going to encourage developers to be building houses on the sites of old offices, or maybe even converting them.
Getting developers to build on old office sites. Well, yes, that's a good idea. Get somebody else to solve our problem. That's straightforward.
But I mean, what's going to be the result of the losing nearly 100 hostel places, in your view, in the city, if that does take place?
Oh, those people aren't just going to disappear, are they? I mean, where will they go? Are they going to be still in Bristol? They're still going to be causing problems. Are they going to be causing much more problems for people than they are at the moment? Yeah. So all the problems that people are experiencing through homelessness are going to get much, much worse.
Okay, so Anne Bonney, you're joining us too. Could you give us an idea, because you're a former squatter, can you tell us how you came to be in a situation where you had to find somewhere to live, you found yourself homeless in the city?
Well, I would say that basically I took a rather less spectacular route into homelessness, and one that, as far as I know, is quite common for a lot of people as well. And just simply that it's very hard these days for somebody who's on a low income or who's unemployed or on benefits to get into rented accommodation. So if you look through ads for rented accommodation, you will see that the majority of them say no DSS because landlords will not accept people on benefits. So that, in combination with the fact that housing benefit is now being cut for a lot of people, just basically brings a lot of people into the situation where they cannot find places to live and have to resort to other means of putting a roof over their heads.
Now, it might sound a bit mean, but you're from your accent, you're not a British person. I mean, some people will be saying, well, if you haven't got anywhere to live, you shouldn't be here.
Well, yes, a lot of people do say that, actually. The interesting thing is that where I do come from in Europe, I would probably be in a lot less harsh situation, because I come from a country where there is where there's a lot of laws protecting tenants, where there's a lot of laws, for example, capping rents in certain areas. So landlords just can't go around picking and choosing which tenants they want to take on. It would be illegal there to discriminate against people on the basis that they're on benefits. So if you're asking me why I'm here doing this to myself, I'm probably a bit masochistic.
Okay, Paul, we've got a situation now. In fact, maybe either of you can answer this. I was walking down Cumberland Street this week, which is just off Brunswick Square, just into St Paul's from the city centre, and it's the first time I've ever seen in the city we've got an entire side of that street which is now being boarded up. Now I know, Anne, that you were actually squatting in that street for a while. What on earth is going on? Because, you know, it's not the longest street. There's probably something like about 10 offices and potentially homes as well along there, but every single one of them is boarded up. It's starting to look like a bit of a sort of ghost town.
Well, I can say that one particular one of these buildings in Cumberland Street used to be, ironically, a drop-in centre for homeless people run by the council that was closed down early in the last year.
That's called the Hub, wasn't it?
The Hub, yes, exactly.
I mean, I've been
exactly
in there once or twice myself, yeah.
And that was then subsequently squatted and reopened by a group of homeless people that call themselves the Empowered Homeless, and reopened as a drop-in centre, providing help and advice to homeless people. And was run for about 2 months very successfully until it was evicted. And with the rest of the properties on that street, I think that's something that we see in that whole area around Stokes Croft, that there are plans to develop this area to basically extend the shopping zone that we already have in Cabot Circus and Broadmead. And poor people, squatters, people on low incomes are driven out of this area to redevelop it, and to redevelop it into properties that are just completely out of the range of affordability for people on low incomes.
Isn't this a problem? problem that you come across, Paul. It's actually very difficult for people to get from hostels into permanent accommodation simply because the rents are so high. I mean, we're in a recession. We're supposed to live in a market economy. You would expect that the rents would start coming down, but obviously they don't, do they? They just carry on going up.
Yes, I mean, the reasons for that I really couldn't comment on, but you're absolutely right. And you know, going back to the question about the boarded up places, you know, fundamentally people are keeping those properties empty because they think it makes economic sense for them, you know, because they're driven by the, you know, the economics of the marketplace.
One of the problems, of course, is if someone is actually in your building, you can't sell it at short notice. You know, you've got to actually go through the whole rigmarole of getting the people out, making it vacant. So there's an extent here. And maybe you could talk, maybe you could comment on this, that people are starting to see property that people need to live in simply as a sort of alternative to keeping their money in the bank.
That's true, and I think that at the end of the day there is a fundamental conflict there between the interests of people, fundamental needs like putting a roof over your head in the winter, and the interest of property. And although, like, for example, homelessness charities are completely right in pointing out that homeless people and squatters as well have multiple problems, that they are very vulnerable, that they have problems with substance abuse, mental health, etc., etc., that is not the whole truth. The whole truth is that squatting, for example, is a way for homeless people to take their fate into their own hands, to take control of their needs, and to say these properties are there and our needs just simply override the needs to make profit. And that, of course, doesn't go down well with the people who make money out of property.
Okay, well, what are your rights as a squatter? Maybe you could just explain it in a nutshell, you know, basically what rights you have.
Well, so far, squatting is still not illegal. The government is making strong efforts to change this. The government has just epically failed in the attempt to criminalise squatting, because the amendment that was meant to do that was attached to the Legal Aid Bill, which has just been thrown out in the House of Lords. So for quite a while, we will not see this happening, but it's not off the table yet. But the situation is still that it is not illegal to occupy an empty building as long as no criminal damage is committed in getting into that property, and that if the property owner wants to get squatters out of there, they have to go to court, to a civil court, and basically get a possession order.
If they can.
If
they do all their paperwork.
Well,
right.
They usually can in the end, but sometimes it does take quite a while.
And now you've actually got a permanent roof over your head, or semi-permanent anyway. So how did you get from squatting into actually some more permanent accommodation?
Well, I was lucky enough to find work while I was still squatting, which was very, very difficult, and only worked because it is work that I can do from home, ironically. And having this job then allowed me to get into housing. But I was very, very lucky to find work in this economic climate, and that is something that is very, very difficult for a lot of people. I do have qualifications. I have 2 academic degrees, and I was struggling, so I can't even begin to imagine what it's like for, say, a single parent with children, somebody who's got mental health or health difficulties, who can't find work.
Okay, Anne, thanks very much. Paul, I saw you nodding away when Anne was talking about the potential, anyway, to take control of your own housing situation, especially when you can see so many empty buildings around you.
Absolutely. I would like to point out that squatting encompasses a whole range of different experiences, you know, from people doing it for, you know, ethical, you know, moral, you know, great, you know, ecologically friendly motives, through to people who cannot, can't tell you what day of the week it is, and just their lives have fallen apart, and massive range of experience of squatting. You know, some squatters are in places that you'd find it hard to distinguish from a normal family home. Other people are living in squats that are basically derelict building sites.
And what's, because I know the council's doing a consultation on what to do about the homeless at the moment. I mean, we were hearing also there about the potential of making squatting illegal, and also closing down whatever it is, 80 or so, I mean, hostel beds. Yes. What is going to be the effect of this?
It's absolutely disastrous. And they're doing this at the same time as the government are reducing housing benefit. So from the 1st of January, housing benefit for people under 35 is going to be absolutely slashed. So the housing benefit that people would have been able to claim is just not going to be there anymore, and the places that they might have been able to access are just not going to be available to them. So you've got this double whammy as well. It's just complete disaster.
Okay, can you just finally wrap up, Paul, and tell us where your cafe is for homeless people and when it's open?
Okay, we're at 32 Stapleton Road. It's the Wild Goose, and we're open Monday to Friday from 10 till 3 o'clock and from 8 till 10 in the evening, and Sunday evenings from 8 till 10.
Okay, and Bonnie and Paul Hazelden, thank you very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way for now, because after the Sky News at 7, Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Eastern John Keeley, and also to Bristol Squatter and Bonnie, to Paul Hazelden from Crisis Centre Ministries, and finally also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. For the next 2 weeks over the Christmas break, we'll be a politician free zone here, as we're joined by Masters graduate Polly Winch, who produces the news sheet for Occupy Bristol, and we discuss the week and the year's big stories, replacing the politicians with a bit of music. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times. Just go to the BCFM website, bcfm.org.uk, or you can take a shortcut and go to thisweek.org.uk to get all our old shows. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky.